Before we get started this evening, I will hope to give us some possibilities for Bible readings. I know that a few people have been thankful for that and really appreciated that. But I didn't have a chance to do that this morning, and we are at the end of our year, so I always want to do that. But I did want to share something, one thing with you, one option. If you wanted to make an investment, various bookstores have what are called reading Bibles. Reading editions of the Bible. And I was actually gifted this by Bruce and Beulah Tooley, who were actually here a few weeks ago. And this is a really neat tool, or nice tool. And the nice thing about it is there's no paragraph headings and there's no numbers. So, and there's no notes either. So that really cuts down on a lot of the extraneous stuff in your Bible. And I was breaking down basically what I would have to average, less than 5 pages in this Bible a day. You think you could read 5 pages a day in the Scriptures? Yeah, I think so. And that just makes it that much easier, that much more accessible. So if you're interested in kind of looking at this just to see, you know, what that would look like, then I'd be happy to share that with you. And I'll have some plans too available. We'll do the chronology option. We'll do the genre Bible reading option. I think this legacy one that at least Libby and I did last year was really helpful too. It provided some flexibility, and perhaps that's what you're looking for. And one thing I want to introduce, too, is a 2-year Bible reading plan. Sometimes it can, you know, we live very hectic and busy lives. So if you want to read the Bible over the course of 2 years as opposed to one, then that's a nice option, too. And I've seen a few of those kind of floating around. So I'll work on that this afternoon and get those available to us, hopefully this evening. We are picking up in 1 Timothy 2. And at the end of class, before worship, I will try and get a handout provided. That's the qualifications for deacons. And I have some copies of those I wanted to share with you. I put it up on Facebook. Really less than half the qualifications of the elders. So we can go through that probably pretty quickly, especially given the fact that there's only 10 or 11 of these, and then half of them we already looked at in regards to the elders. So we're only really going to be looking at 6 or so in depth, and those really kind of spin off of some of the elder qualifications. So that would be really helpful, I think, to look through that. That'll be where we'll begin next time. We are looking at 1 Timothy 2. We're going to wrap up 1 Timothy 2 here this morning so that we can begin afresh with the qualifications of deacons next year, tomorrow, next Sunday. 1 Timothy 2, let's go ahead and read again verses 9 through 15. Breeze, would you mind reading that for us?
Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modesty, and discreetly. Not with braided hair and gold scrolls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works. This is proper for women making a claim to godliness. A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. But I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man to remain quiet. For it was Adam who was first created and then Eve, and it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being deceived, fell into transgression. But women will be preserved through the bearing of children if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint.
All right, thank you. So we have talked about verses 9 and 10, the 3 requirements of the Christian's clothing. Of course, talking specifically about women here, but it would be naturally true of men as well, that men need to dress modestly. It's just more focused on the New Testament in regards to females. But all those rules would apply. We've got 3 rules there. We've got propriety, we've got modesty, and we've got discretion. We talked about those for the past 2 weeks. So let's go ahead and move on to verses 11 through 15, since we've established those principles. And that stems really into the concept of submission. And I shared a couple things with you last week, and I added a few quotes to the slideshow. So if we can get to them, great. If not, that's okay too. But this is really some of the first pictures that you see on Google when you type in this passage. And a lot of them deal with a misunderstanding of this passage. They deal with the idea of men claiming superiority, that the Bible is sexist, that the Bible doesn't support women, the Bible wants to keep women down, you know, that kind of concept. And obviously that runs very contradictory to the women's liberation movement that we've seen recently. And there is no dispute that there has been equality that's been expressed over time between different groups of people. There's been racism that's been shown. There's been sexism that's been shown. We're really not dealing with that. What we're dealing with is the equality, nevertheless, different roles of men and women. And so one of the things that we want to do is we want to show a couple things in regards to how we can understand this correctly and how valuable of a passage this is. What we did last week, we went through this slide. And this basically, submission is not a punishment. Submission is a privilege. And you think about what Jesus did. Jesus submitted to the Father. The Christ submits to Jesus. Or the church submits to Christ Jesus. And so we have the idea of submission as reflected even in the Godhead not being inequality. The scriptures are very clear about that. Not being inferiority, but rather being a choice. A choice that produces an ideal situation. And if you look out in our world today, do you see a lot of this ideal situation where a man loves his wife and supports and nourishes his wife, and the wife respects her husband, and the children are being trained up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? We don't see that all that often. This provides for the ideal. And if we're looking as Christians to serve God, we should be striving for this ideal. This is a choice that we make. Humility is always a choice. Submission is always a choice. And in the way that the Bible describes it. So, a couple things just to review from last week. There is a dispute about, is this women or is this wife? And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a couple of slides. They must quietly receive instruction. Quietly is the idea of not total silence. That's why in our Bible classes, women can speak up. They're not usurping authority. They're merely asking a question of somebody who maintains authority over the class. And so the concept here is kind of a disputatious attitude, the idea of not being submissive, the idea of being maybe a wild bronco is kind of the idea. Receive instruction. It really should be receiving instruction. It's kind of the present tense. Unfortunately, some people will misuse that and say, well, so long as it isn't the rule that a woman exercises authority, that's okay. And that's not what this passage is teaching. This passage is teaching that even in those exceptions, that is an issue. Now, are there situations where a woman might exercise authority? Yeah. If a mother's ever spanked her child, then that's exercising authority. If a mother's ever, or a woman has ever taught a Bible class with kids, then that's exercising authority. There are situations that allow for them to exercise authority. The consideration that's being made here is they're not allowed to exercise authority over a man. And that deals with, you know, some issues of age of accountability, whether or not a boy becomes a Christian. But we're not really going to get into that. Just wanted to lay that groundwork. They are to do this with entire submissiveness. Hupotage. Hupotage is elsewhere translated humility. And it's the idea of submission. That's what we're talking about. The pattern, the attitude of submission is what we're looking for here. And certainly we could talk about the male role and the female role. I just want to stick to this passage if we can. Sometimes we can get that Peter mindset. Well, what are you going to do with him? What about him? What's his responsibility? We'll deal with that, trust me. 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, we'll deal with that. But right now we're talking about women. So let's make sure that we kind of stick to the passage if possible. A couple of passages or a couple of quotations that I want to share with you. This is from Gareth Reese. Gareth Reese has a great set of commentaries, but they're really thick. They're kind of intimidating. They're gray and blue. And he said this, and I think this is really helpful. Such subordination or submissiveness, like what's talked about in this passage, voluntarily done, is not degrading. It's not dishonoring. There is no suggestion that woman is man's toy or slave. As the church is not dishonored by being subject to Christ, as Christ is not dishonored by being subject to the Father, so neither is woman dishonored by being submissive. In fact, just the opposite is true. The one who submits finds in it a place of ultimate fulfillment. You think Jesus knew what that ultimate fulfillment was when he submitted to the Father to the point of death on the cross? Yeah. Philippians 2 tells us, because of that, he was exalted, and at his name, every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess. There is an exaltation in humility. He who humbles himself will be exalted. Remember that whenever you need motivation to fulfill this passage. There's a payoff, if you want to think of it that way. Albert Barnes in 1 Corinthians, in his Barnes notes, he said, the woman was made for the comfort and happiness of the man. You know, Genesis 2 says it's not good for man to be alone. There's a problem there. God deals with that. And he compliments that. Not to be a slave, but a helpmeet. Not to be the minister of his pleasure, but to be his aid and comforter in life. Not to be regarded as of inferior nature and rank, but to be his friend, to divide his sorrows, and to multiply and extend his joys, yet still to be in a station subordinate to him. He is to be the head, the ruler, the presider in the family circle, and she was created to aid him in his duties, to comfort him in his afflictions, to partake with him in his pleasures. It's a complementary role. And so, whenever we get this kickback that Satan pumps into this world, well, that's inferiority. Well, you shouldn't be held down. No, that's a place of exaltation. That's a place of the ideal reality that we can put ourselves in. That's the ideal situation for us. That's the ideal situation, or for women, I guess. That's the ideal situation for the husband. That's the ideal situation for the children, if you're blessed to have any. It's ideal to be in this situation. It's not keeping you down. This is a longer quote, and this is from Horace Huggins. Horace Huggins wrote or did a lesson in one of the Florida College lectures. I have the reference there on the second slide. Really great article. It's only about probably 15 pages. If you want to read through it, it's really great. It's about some of the influences, particularly of the women's liberation movement on the Christian woman and some of the impacts there. Really great lesson that he did. He said, in consequence of women having accepted the world's opinion of what their role in life should be, many American women have come to believe that they are enslaved by housework and imprisoned by their children. They have been told that they are insulting their education. They're squandering their potentials. They are being told to take off their aprons and put their children in day nurseries and go out and fulfill themselves. The experts are telling women they must choose between the exhausted mother surrounded by toddlers and chained to the stove and the brilliant woman on the other end of the feminine spectrum who is fulfilling herself through meaningful work outside the home. But women need to know that they do not have to choose one extreme or the other. They need to understand that the most delightful, fruitful, and satisfying role in life is that of a godly wife who is set to the task of making her home a haven of peace and comfort, a place of joy and happiness, honoring her husband and joining with him and bringing up their children, the nurture and admonition of the Lord. I really love that comment. You're not chained to the stove, but also don't fall under the illusion that Satan's pumping into this world. That in order to be fulfilled, you have to leave your children behind. In order to be fulfilled, you have to leave your husband behind. That's not true. Now, are there situations where a woman might have to work? Yes. Absolutely. Proverbs 31 gives us an example of a woman who works. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about neglect of the household. A neglect of the household, a neglect upon her children, a neglect upon her husband, a neglect upon herself, really, at the end of the day. Because she's choosing not to live in the ideal circumstance. So, a couple of comments, or a couple of quotations I wanted to share with you. We got one more. That's from Ruth Hazelwood. It's from a Christian woman, actually. It was written a little while back. I just read this book recently, The Challenge of Being a Wife. Not to learn how to be a wife, but in preparation for this role and in this class. Nearly everyone, everywhere, one turn. TV, radio, magazines, newspapers, old standards and ideas are being constantly challenged. Women are caught up in a world of doubt and confusion as to their identity and purpose in life. Many have lost sight of their true value and their importance in the home. This is due in part to worldly leaders and even some religious leaders who are teaching and pushing false standards and goals. There are many conflicting opinions and words of advice to women about how they find fulfillment. There is much to do about obtaining freedom and being liberated. Now, this is actually, if I'm not mistaken, about 40 years ago, about a generation ago. And so we're seeing kind of the fruit of that, what she's hinting at 40 years ago. A couple of passages in the scriptures that deal with preparing women so that they can accept this role. Titus chapter 2 and verses 3 through 5, great passage. And we'll deal with this concept more when we get to that, because there are some specific details that are shared here that will really help us. Titus 2 verses 3 through 5. Debbie, can you read that for us?
Older women likewise are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good, so that they may encourage the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sensible, pure, workers at home, kind, being subject to their own husbands, so that the word of God will not be dishonored.
All right, so there's a role here. Whose chief responsibility is it to instruct younger women? Older women. Do we see that? I don't think we see it as much as probably we should. Because this passage tells us in verse 4, New American Standard says encourage. You have the New King James. I think the New King James says teach. To teach. These things have to be taught. Love for a husband, love for the children. These are challenging things. They have to be encouraged. They have to be stimulated. And who does that stimulation? Eric might do a lesson once a year on it. But really, this is the primary responsibility of older women. This is the responsibility of those who have been there. They've done that. They've got the t-shirt. Are we sharing that insight? You know, we talk a lot about, you know, leadership classes and song leading classes. And I've shared an idea recently. I want to maybe do a class on how to lead prayers when we're doing the Lord's Supper and how different prayers can be offered and how we can maybe get out of some of the ruts that we sometimes fall into. Do we have women's classes where these kinds of insights are shared? I think that would be a great idea. Maybe a goal for 2018, making kingdom choices. Like we've talked about so often. Another passage that deals with this as well, 1 Timothy 5, verse 14. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach. Some have already turned aside to follow Satan. And that passage, of course, dealing with widows particularly and how we're to approach that. Older women can be added to the list if they meet certain qualifications. That way they can be supported by the church. Younger widows have to be encouraged and strengthened to perhaps get remarried so that they do not fall into condemnation. We'll talk more about these passages when we get to them, but I wanted to lay that groundwork out there just to say, look, there's a need in our society. There's a need in the church. These younger women that are coming up, these younger women are playing an integral role in training up elders, deacons, preachers, citizens of our society, people that might be in positions of leadership. That's their role. That's what they're doing right now. That's what they are involved in. And if they can stimulate them effectively, if they can receive that encouragement that they need to stimulate them effectively, then that can create a better world. And aren't we all invested in that? At least in some capacity. A better church, certainly. Go ahead, Teresa.
I was going to say, all of a sudden, looking at it, because I've been working with young people, and reaching out a little bit to the ladies, you know, because, well, some of us weren't raised in a long time, you know, and you just, you don't know how that
sugar. Chained down.
Yeah.
Inhibited. I think that'll be good. I'm glad you're reaching out too, as a mother of a young child. Again, I would reiterate, are there occasions where both parents need to be working? Yes, there are. Is that ideal? I don't think so, because of what's expressed here. Because of, you know, just think about this. And I was reading in this FC lecture that Horace Huggins had written, and he quoted somebody, and I can't remember who the quotation was from, but he was saying, look, people only have so much energy. And if both parents are working outside of the home, full-time jobs, there's only so much energy that's had at the end of the day. And so we have to consider that, just from a practical standpoint. Are we doing this as kind of a stopgap in order to provide a need that is necessarily experienced? Or are we doing this to fulfill ourselves because for some reason we feel chained down at home? We have to think about the attitude behind this. We have to think about the needs that are behind this and whether or not perhaps the husband's job can support the family. And the husband needs to take that in consideration too. Are we able to live off of my income? Can I strive for something better? Or is he becoming content in a situation that is forcing a strain on his family? Just something to consider. I know there's probably 100 different things that we could look at and related to that. But we're dealing with the ideal here. We're dealing with how we can affect the most influence in our families. And certainly we all want to do that to the best of our abilities. We live in a world of challenges. We live in a world that tries to influence us against that ideal. And so I want to make sure that we are fighting against that. Any comments or questions? Okay. You've probably seen this before. It's a really old graphic. It's God's umbrella of protection. Of course, you have God. You could put Christ in here too, because Christ submits to the Father. You've got the husband. He's to provide and protect for his family. He's to engage in a profession and engage in activities that stimulate his family. And some of these concepts falling under the Titus 2, 3 through 5 and 1 Timothy 5, 14 concepts. And you can see this reflected too in 1 Corinthians 11. In that discussion of the head covering, there is a concept of that headship and the way that God has set things in order. We'll make a few references to those later, but that is God's divine order. But nevertheless, I wanted to share this with you, and this deals with is this a wife or is this a woman passage? Who is she submissive to? Well, God. God certainly would be involved in that. You got passages like Hebrews 12, 9, James 4, 7, submit to God, and he'll draw near to you. 2 Corinthians 9, verse 13, in the context of the giving. She's to submit to authorities. We've talked about that, civil authorities, insofar as they abide in God. I think also what would fall under that is leadership in the church. Elders, she is to submit to elders. She is to submit to those who are leading songs. She is to submit to those who are leading classes, to those who are preaching, that kind of a concept. So that's why I use the term authorities there. This is very broad. We have those concepts. We have submitting to her husband. Well, that's true. Ephesians 5 teaches us that much. And other passages as well, Colossians 3, Titus 2, we just read Titus 2, 3 through 5, 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 6. It gives the example of who? Called her husband little L, Lord. Sarah. Sarah's an example. So if you want to be encouraged, you want to be stimulated, you want to be motivated to be the ideal woman, think about Sarah. Maybe that could be the basis of one of those classes that y'all might have. Talk about Sarah and that passage in particular, about how she illustrates really some of the great essentials of what we're talking about. So I don't know if it's... Well, first of all, I don't know if it's wise to kind of press this divide between wife and woman in this passage, because it is establishing several things at once. And sometimes we can get so focused on nailing something to the left that we forget all of what's to the right. So I thought that this would be helpful to show this diagram, to show that this would be true in several different instances. Now, in regards to the second one and the first one, this pertains to a woman who's not married as well. Now, in regards to this third one, this is more specific to a woman who is married. For example, Fred and Connie. You guys aren't married. What if Fred says, well, Connie, you need to come over and clean my house. That's your role as a woman. Would that be true? Connie says, yeah, right. That's what we're talking about here, okay? So we can understand that distinction. But if Fred, as an elder, says, Connie, I think it would be really good maybe for you to study this passage, or maybe for you to share some insights with this person about some experience in your life, would that be something that you could submit to, Connie? Absolutely. Because of the role. Because of the functioning there. And so the concept of headship governs that relationship, but it doesn't govern a relationship that is non-existent. That is, that you are not married together. Make sense? Understand the distinction? The next one is a quote from Marshall Patton. Marshall Patton wrote the Truth Commentary, and I have a quote from that later on. But he actually, the quote that I'm going to share with you is not from the Truth Commentary. It's from Searching the Scriptures. Remember that? That old magazine? From 1976. Morals Under Fire said, man's role too may be viewed as routine, boring, and frustrating. Face competition from nearly every viewpoint. Among fellow workers, sales, contracts, merchandise. He must pay the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. Bills, bills, and more bills. He must deal with and try to solve the problems of his company. Listen to complaints of employers, supervisors. But again, when properly viewed, such a role is rewarding. When self is forgotten in service to others, satisfaction fills the soul. Honor, esteem, and distinction become his crown. He is a recipient of appreciation from among his associates and of the greatest possible measure of love from those who know him best. When both man and woman fill their God-ordained roles, they find bliss and fulfillment for both time and eternity. Now, I wanted to share this because, again, what does our society tell women? You stay at home? You don't work? You got an education and you're not using that education? Maybe you are. Maybe not in the way that they're expecting, but maybe you are. And so, you know, I think what Satan has done is he's tried to interject this discontent into our society. This discontent of the ideal situation. That's not enough. You got to do more. You got to find true fulfillment. You're not going to find fulfillment chained to the stove. We can become discontent in our circumstances, but that is only really reflective, if we're in the ideal circumstances, that's only reflective of our attitude and our lack of submission to God. When we view this properly, that role is rewarding. And when a husband and a wife, or a woman in general in regards to what we talked about previously, or a man in general, in regards to that kind of a situation as well, when we find ourselves in that role, and we are dedicated to Christ, and we are pressing forward, then that is rewarding. Maybe not in the same way that society tells us, maybe not in the same way that Satan tells us, but we're not looking to the definitions of society, we're not looking to the definitions of Satan, we're looking to the definitions of Christ. And Christ tells us very clearly that in these roles, we should be fulfilled if we're maintaining the right attitude. Agreeable? Now, we'll take that off the screen in case you didn't see it. This had to do with one of our questions. This was question 10 in the book. Question 10 said, upon what timeless argument does Paul bind this command? It's in verses 13 and 14. Adam and Eve. He goes all the way back to creation. You notice he does not say, in Greco-Roman society, it is typically accepted that a woman submit to her husband. He doesn't do that. And so a lot of people will dismiss this passage based upon a cultural more. And that was in regards to question 8 there. A cultural more. They'll dismiss the passage and say, well, yeah, that was how things were in the first century, but today is different. Women have a better place. They have a better estimation of themselves. They're a better treatment. No, this goes back to a timeless argument. This goes back to creation. This is not dependent on Greco-Roman society. This is not dependent on Jewish society. This is going back to Adam and Eve. And that tells us that this is not a personal disinclination. The next point was in regards to question 6, kind of latter part of question 6. Does this passage prevent women from teaching in a secular situation? I don't think so. I don't believe so at all. We're not dealing with a violation of authority. We're merely sharing intelligence. You know, for instance, I had Annetta Hastings, Christian woman, who taught me calculus in college. Did she violate some biblical principle in doing that? No, I don't think so. Now, we might find people that hold that viewpoint, and to the best of our ability, we can submit to that. Insofar as that would be a weak point for them. But we're not dealing with that. What we're dealing with here is we're dealing with a violation of authority. We're dealing with authority, we're dealing with the concept of submission. So the situation does determine the principles that are addressed. I'll give you another illustration. When I was in college, I had the opportunity to go down to a church in Bradenton, Florida. The church was very small, 10 women, no men. If I was not there, and if there were no men there, who would govern the services? Could they not have services because a man wasn't there? No. They would have to do it. Now, is that an exception to the rule? Yeah, you don't find that across the board. But again, the situation that we're dealing with does determine the principles that are invoked.
Just in the submission of male and female idea, I was a supervisor for 18 years, and it makes it kind of difficult for men to submit to a woman that's really sticky sometimes. But, and then, also going from a single woman at 40 to a married woman, so that's
Yeah, and I think that that deals, I want to be careful how I phrase it. This class, I think, really needs to be phrased correctly. The difficulty that you face is not uncommon for somebody that is in the workplace to be able to differentiate between the workplace and secular situation and in the home. If you're used to supervisory work, if you're used to managerial work outside of the home, can that have implications inside the home? Is that line hard not to cross? I think so. And so that creates an issue too, at least a possible issue. And that needs to be something that if we're going to be working outside of the home, which, again, not anything inherently bad about that. If you're going to be working outside the home, if you're going to be in a leadership position of that nature, that does create an extra obstacle for you. So you have to be aware of that and try to the best of your ability to govern that. And if you're not able to govern that, perhaps to step down from that role. Louis.
I think it's good for a husband in a situation like that to realize that he's not the boss, too.
Yeah.
Being a leader and being a boss does not necessarily mean the same thing. Obviously, there's some overlap.
Yeah. I think so. I hate phrasing stuff like that in a Bible class. There's a really good model in the concept of shepherding. Elders are shepherds in the church. I think fathers are shepherds in the home. And if we're to use it kind of in a broader sense, I think a father and a mother are shepherds of their children. And I've been reading a book recently called Shepherding the Young Child's Heart by Ted Tripp. Really great book. It's Calvinistic, so he's talking sometimes about women corrupt or children corrupted from birth, and so you got to just kind of dismiss that. But he looked at this idea of us shepherding our children and helping them and encouraging them and stimulating them. And how does a shepherd lead his sheep? They follow him. They recognize his voice. It's primarily based on influence. He's not driving cattle, he's leading sheep, if that makes sense. Good point, Louis. Couple more points I want to share with you. The word that's used here for authority is not the typical word that's used. The word that's used here is authentein. Authentein is not the opposite, but it's a different word from exousia. Exousia is pretty much the word we see across the board in the New Testament for authority in a variety of different situations. The term that's used here is authentein. Authentein comes from autos. Autos means me. Me. And so it's not it's really focusing on the concept of attitude in this passage, which was verses 9 and 10 as well. That they need to govern themselves in propriety and modesty and discretion. That wasn't just in regards to the physical clothing, it was in regards to their attitude. And so we are dealing with an attitude issue here as well. That you're driving your own agenda against your husband. And I mentioned that present tense earlier. This is kind of a relevant thing. Gnosticism really became full-blown in the 2nd century, but that doesn't mean that Gnostic ideas weren't floating around. I think in the New Testament we see a lot of Gnostic ideas that are being addressed before it gets fully developed. But Gnosticism taught that Eve pre-existed Adam, and that her intentions were good in taking of the fruit. And so Paul here would be correcting the seeds of this heresy, first of all, by saying that Adam was the first created, and then also pointing out that Eve was the one who was deceived, and that she partook of the fruit first. Again, is a woman subject only to her husband or to man? Marshall Patton, the Truth Commentary, let it be observed that while woman was created to be a helpmeet for man, which demands a subordinate position, she nevertheless is the crowning act of all of God's creation. No creature has been endowed with more beauty, loveliness, grace, tenderness, and gentleness, all of which not only completely qualify her, but make her to excel as the companion she was meant to be. For this reason, her throne of glory is in the home. Again, that's a great place to be. If you are blessed to be in that situation, it is not because shackles have been put on you. And to the best of our ability, we need to try and find ourselves in that position. And that's, again, because that's where fulfillment will be found, more so than climbing the corporate ladder. Priest.
In a husband-wife relationship, because of this, we have to remember the husband also has responsibility as he's the one who strikes on the church. That doesn't mean if he doesn't, I mean, the woman still has a responsibility. But when that is the case, it works beautifully.
Oh, yeah.
It's perfect.
It's perfect. And another thing that stems from that, first... 1 Peter 3:7, he is to live with her as a weaker vessel. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that he is designed for his role and she's designed for her role. That's exactly what that means. And in that situation is found harmony. Another quote is from Albert Barnes. When she is absent from the home, no matter what good she may be doing elsewhere, there is a silent evil reigning, which can be removed only by her return. There is only so much energy that we have. And if you're exercising all of that fuel somewhere else, and you get back home, it's going to be hard to fulfill that role. Especially indefinitely. A few more slides in regards to Adam and Eve. Adam was created first. The Bible demonstrates as much. Gnosticism taught elsewise, but it's very clear from the Bible that man was created first. And so Eve was created second. And that's the same argument that's made in 1 Corinthians 11. Multiple passages that establish this premise. The woman was created for man as a helper. Again, a lot of people kind of balk at that concept, but that's what Genesis 2 teaches. It's not good for man to be alone. There's an issue that can arise from man being alone. He needs help. He needs a complementary role. He needs somebody to strengthen his strengths, or strengthen his weaknesses and strengthen his strengths. And so again, that's the ideal situation. Eve was deceived, thus contributing to this submissive role. Now, I think there's really two arguments here. Adam was created first, and that puts him in a position of headship. Eve, through deception first, I think, contributed to that submissive role. So there's really two reasons here, I believe, that are cited for this. The order of creation and the order of sin. And again, that doesn't preclude men being able to be deceived. Of course, men can be deceived. We see it all the time. And this is a point you ladies probably will appreciate. Adam willingly sinned. He partook of the fruit. He didn't require deception. One quote here from Albert Barnes, a couple from him today. In the most important situation in which she was ever placed, she had shown that she was not qualified to take the lead. She had evinced a readiness to yield to temptation, a feebleness of resistance, a pliancy of character which showed that she was not adapted to the situation of headship, which made it proper that she should ever afterward occupy a subordinate situation. The woman should remember that sin began with her, and she should therefore be willing to occupy an humble and subordinate situation. Oftentimes, particularly when we're reading through the New Testament, we come across passages like Romans 5, for instance, that says, through Adam, sin was introduced into the world. And there certainly is a responsibility on Adam's part and his failure. There's also this passage that talks about the failure on the part of Eve. And so we have to consider both of those passages as they relate to what we're talking about here. Ruth Hazelwood, great little book. If I could find it, I'd be happy to share that with anybody who's interested in it. And she talked about kind of the solution to this problem that we're seeing in society. If we women are to play a major role in making our families what they should be, we must take stock of ourselves as women carefully, prayerfully, and critically. This means an objective consideration of our family and the factors which brought us to this point, plus a clear vision of where we want to go and the ways and means by which we get there. We are spinning our wheels unless we realize whatever changes are to be made in our husbands and children must occur first in ourselves as wives and mothers. This is a case for a firm commitment to an idea of self and demands a constant, determined effort to bring about the needed changes. Very quickly, verse 15. Verse 15 is a difficult verse. Christians, translators, commentators have a hard time with this. What is the concept of preservation that is being talked about here? Who is the woman or who is the women? Or who are the women who this is true of? This does not teach that women cannot get to heaven unless they become mothers. I just want to be clear about that, and that's related to one of our questions. Preserved or saved, I prefer the concept of saved, and I'll explain why. Because grammatically speaking, the pronouns that are used are singular, not plural. Now, what's the significance of that? I think the significance of that is, this is just a fancy word for saying the first prophecy in Scripture, Genesis 3, verse 15. The seed of Eve would crush the head of the serpent. That's where salvation came from. Is it true also that as a woman conducts herself as God expects, then that solidifies her salvation? Yes. So I wouldn't really press that difference too hard. But as far as grammatically, the references, the pronouns that are used here are singular. Through the woman, salvation will come to her child. Or through the woman, salvation will come through her child is the concept that we're dealing with here. Really, that's the best explanation for this, given the grammar, given the setup. I'd also add this. The children are not required to be Christians in order for the mother to gain access to heaven. If we're going to look at it that from the accommodative perspective, then we need to understand that difference as well. I want to share one last thing with you, and that's just a syllogism. And hopefully this is helpful for you. Adam is to Christ, is to the Romans 15 discussion, as Eve is to Mary, the mother of Jesus, as to 1 Timothy 2:15. Make sense? If you want me to explain that a little bit further, I'd be happy to do that, but we're out of time. I think we did a good job today. Didn't get as much comments because Eric was pedal to the metal a little bit. So if you have any lingering questions, please let me know. And I'll be handing out these qualifications for deacons. Daily Bible readers.